Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. You're a lawyer and practiced real estate law in Seattle and have worked in land and wildlife conservation in Wyoming, Costa Rica, Canada, and Montana. Now you're in Bozeman, director of the Gallatin Valley Land Trust. What have you learned along the way? Penelope Pierce is about to tell us. Penelope, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us a little about your background. Where did your folks grow up?
My mother is from Great Britain, and my father was from Ohio, and they met in Washington, D.C. My mother has a Ph.D. in organic chemistry, which is fairly daunting growing up.
Yes, and for her time, quite significant, I would say.
Very significant. She grew up in England, and her mother basically said, you should probably get an education in case you don't get married. And my mother wanted to be a doctor, but she faints at the sight of blood, so she decided to be an organic chemist instead. And she published two books for American University in her 70s, which was wonderful, very proud of her. She's now 89, and she came over to the United States when she was in her early 30s, and she met my father in Washington, D.C. at a party, listening to the Trout Quintet, and that's how they met and fell in love. My father was a stockbroker by profession and a volcanologist by avocation.
Now, a volcanologist.
He studied volcanoes, and he was self-taught in that respect, and he and my mother spent a lot of my childhood chasing volcanoes around the world. So we had an interesting upbringing.
Chasing volcanoes is a phrase I hadn't heard. Did you go with your parents looking for volcanoes and volcanic activity during your childhood, or was that past?
No. We would sit through long slideshows when they got back. But they had pictures of my father on lava fields with his shoes smoking and small planes circling active volcanoes. They probably risked their lives more than once, and we never knew about it.
Did it affect you in any way?
It fostered my sort of wanderlust and wanting to get out and see the world, as did my mother leaving England to move to the United States, and she never went back. And so I was always very jealous that I didn't get to go on these trips with my parents.
Any siblings?
I have one sister who's 2 years older than me.
Okay, school. What about college?
Grew up back east in Washington, D.C. I went to the College of William & Mary, which is arguably the oldest college in the United States, founded in 1693. I studied, to the horror of my mother, hope she doesn't listen to this, psychology and sociology, which she did point out to me is not science.
Do you agree?
I do not agree. Okay. And I loved it. And that education has served me throughout my career. I believe that firmly as a conservationist, as a lawyer, having a background in psychology and sociology was very, very helpful.
Give me an example of how psychology or sociology would be helpful in your law practice or your conservation work.
Well, conservation in my mind is a social science. I mean, what we're trying to do, whether it's protecting grizzly bears, saving private land, water and soil, we're dealing with people every single day, and we're hoping to get people to do things that we want them to do to protect the things that we love. So being able to talk to people, being able to convince people, being able to understand people and what's important to them is psychology. And same right. with a law practice. Again, you're dealing with people trying to affect behavior at the end of the day, truly. And so I think having that background was priceless. I don't regret it for one moment. I loved studying it. I think it's interesting. And as I said, it's been helpful for my 26-year career.
And how about sociology?
Same thing. I think looking at sort of the broader picture about how societies work and how communities work is affecting behavior. And those two tie very neatly into law and all of the work that I've done here and abroad.
Why law school?
There's a good question. So I graduated with my degree in psychology and sociology and said, now what? I said, my parents didn't tell me what to do after college. And so I thought, okay, now what do I do with this degree? And my cousin had worked in Yellowstone National Park and said, go work in Yellowstone National Park. And we had never been west as a family. We would go back to England to visit my grandparents. So unlike a lot of folks in my generation, we didn't do the national parks. And so I thought, I'll go to Yellowstone National Park. So that's what I did. And I came out here in the summer of 1985. And I remember I landed in Billings because Bozeman didn't have an airport that had service at that point. And I remember getting off the plane in Billings and thinking, this doesn't look quite like the pictures that they sent me from the park. What have I done? I'll never forget, I was 22 and sort of overwhelmed, and this very nice man in a snap button shirt and a large belt buckle and polyester pants and cowboy boots said, "May I help you, ma'am?" And he gave me a ride in his taxi down to the bus station, and I thought, this is going to be great. And then I rode the bus from Billings down to Livingston and then into Gardner, and I remember the minute I fell in love, which was driving down the Paradise Valley. And again, this is 85, so it was a very different place, and it was so spectacular. And I thought, this is my place. I am home.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Penelope Pierce, who's executive director of the Gallatin Valley Land Trust, about her long and diverse involvement in conservation. So how did feeling you were home lead you to law school?
Well, I worked in the park for 2 summers and a winter and really loved it and was out in nature all the time. And I realized that what I wanted to do was help protect those places. And the way to do that was to get a law degree. So I went to the University of Oregon and studied environmental law.
Your bio says you practiced law, real estate law, land use law after law school. Why? For how long? How did it work out?
Well, I went to a large law firm in Seattle after law school. Again, I'd studied environmental law, and I wanted to be a plaintiff's attorney. I was given advice to work for a large law firm and pay off some of my debts and get a lot of experience. So I went to a law firm in Seattle, and land use and real estate was sort of as close as I could get to what I was doing, with the hope of doing pro bono work for environmental causes. And I was sort of known as the weed-eating, tree-hugging granola girl at the law firm. So that didn't last for very long. So I did that for about 2 years and realized that large law firms were not my calling. And that's when I departed Seattle.
Then what?
I went to work for the Nature Conservancy in Lander, Wyoming, doing conservation easements. And I don't know if you remember this, but on my very first day working for the Nature Conservancy, I flew up here with the then State Director Ben Pierce to Bozeman, and I met Brian Kahn, and I believe Guy Bonnevere. So I met you on my first day of work for the Nature Conservancy in 1993.
Because then I was the State Director, and Ben had worked in the office when I came here, and Guy was the State Director in Idaho.
Yep.
So what did you do for TNC in Wyoming?
I was their conservation director, and so I was negotiating conservation easements throughout the state, and I did that for 3 years.
At that time, were you buying easements, or were people still donating easements?
They were doing both, but most of the easements that I worked on were donated easements. So a conservation easement is a voluntary agreement between landowners and land trusts. Nature Conservancy is a land trust, Gallatin Valley Land Trust is a land trust, wherein the owners are basically giving up their development rights on their property. They continue to own it in fee, they can pass it to their children, they can sell it, but they're giving up their development rights.
Like subdivisions.
Exactly.
Okay.
And in doing that, they're ostensibly giving up some of the value of the land, and so there are tax breaks for them doing that. It's an involved process, but there's a before and after value, and the difference between those two values is considered a charitable donation, which for some people can be significant. And then some easements are also purchased where there's federal funding available, state funding, funding from the land trust in which part of the value of an easement can be purchased.
Okay, so if you purchase an easement for part of its value, there'd be a partial donation which would qualify for a tax credit over time.
That is correct.
And just in case anybody happens to be listening that might be interested, what in summary is the tax play? In other words, how long do they have to take that gift?
So for donation, now Congress just passed a law making this permanent. If someone donates a conservation easement, they can take a tax donation that year. It's up to 50% of adjusted gross income. And then they can also take that deduction and roll it out over the next 15 years. So they have 16 years to use that donation.
That could be a very significant encouragement.
It's a huge encouragement, and the reason a lot of people will do that is because it makes financial sense, and conservation has to make financial sense for folks.
When you say conservation has to make financial sense for folks, what are we talking about in terms of easements? We talk about devoting one's life to working for conservation, which you have, and I'm guessing you could have made more money as a lawyer.
Probably.
citizens who donate time to conservation organizations. I would say there are a lot of people who devote time to conservation, which doesn't make financial sense at all. What would you say to that?
I agree with that. A lot of people donate their time and energy, and it's an act of love, and I appreciate that. But I think when we're talking to folks who are thinking about doing a conservation easement, it's a huge financial decision. And if we can make that a good one, they're more likely to do that. Everyone does this at the end of the day because they care about this place and their land, and they do it for the right reasons. But if you can incentivize people financially, I think conservation will go much further. It's hard to ask people a lot of times to do something good for nothing. And so financial incentives, I think, are wonderful, which is one of the reasons conservation easements are a really great tool.
How did you end up going from Wyoming to Costa Rica? My geography is a little bit rusty, but that's a big shift culturally as well as distance-wise.
It's a big shift every way you look at it. My first husband had property in Costa Rica, and so we decided to go down there, and we lived down there on and off for 10 years doing private land conservation. We had a reforestation project on the Osa Peninsula.
Tell us about it.
So my first husband and I had property in Costa Rica, and along with a lot of our neighboring properties, which was a mixture of local native Costa Ricans and folks from other parts of the world, put our land into a national wildlife refuge, which was under the government. And so that land became protected in certain levels, and it was a lot of the Osa Peninsula, which is a very wild place. It's the only place in Costa Rica that still has four types of monkeys. We had over 700 species of trees.
Costa Rica is a coastal country?
It is.
West or east?
It's on the Pacific.
It's on the Pacific side.
Pacific side, yep. And they have a very strong environmental ethic in that country, thus these wildlife, national wildlife refuges. The wildlife refuge we were part of bordered Corcovado National Park, which was one of the first national parks in Costa Rica. We employed local folks, we all did, and a lot of the local folks owned the property as well. And then when my first husband and I left, we really wanted to protect this land. We placed an easement on it, a conservation easement, with the Nature Conservancy and a local Costa Rican organization. And it was then sold when we left and turned into a wildlife sanctuary. So it will never be developed, and they are doing research there today.
Needless to say, that's an unusual experience, different culture. What did you learn from that experience that you didn't know going down there?
Well, most of my neighbors were locals. They're called Ticos. They're Costa Ricans. And a lot of them have lived there for generations. And they had an incredible tie to the land, an incredible understanding of the land, an incredible love for it and want to protect it. And they were there for generations. And that was their place. And they were perfectly content to be there and nowhere else. And I really admired that. And their sense of place and their sense of community and their sense of family was wonderful. And I learned a lot from them.
It sounds like when you describe it, that there was a degree of those feelings that you hadn't found growing up in the United States. Fair?
I think that is fair. We have a greater sense of wanderlust, which isn't a bad thing, but their sense of contentment, and this is where they were going to be, and no real desire, not that they weren't curious or intelligent, but this was their place, and they were really happy to spend their lives there and devote their lives to that place and making it better and committing to a place, which really putting down roots, which I think is wonderful.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We are talking with Penelope Pierce, Executive Director of the Gallatin Valley Land Trust, about her extensive experience in international conservation. So, after Costa Rica.
After Costa Rica, which was 2004, I came back to the United States and decided that I wanted to be in Bozeman. I fell in love with Bozeman as well when I worked in the park.
They had an airport by then?
They had an airport by then. Yes, they did. And now we have a huge airport. So I came back and I got a job as the U.S. Regional Director for an organization called Yellowstone to Yukon, also known as Y2Y, which was founded in 1993 and was dedicated to sort of large landscape conservation and ensuring that wildlife could move between Yellowstone and the Yukon, where historically there has been a lot of wildlife migration along the spine of the continent, which is the Rocky Mountains. And their goal was to ensure that wildlife could continue to move. And if you build places for them to move, they will, and they can adapt to climate change and human pressures. And so we were dealing with governments in Canada and the United States, several states. It was very interesting. several provinces in Canada, First Nations in Canada. And again, it was to build wildlife corridors or wildlife movement areas so that grizzly bears leaving Yellowstone National Park could migrate north, that there were ways for them to do that so they could get over roads and fences along river corridors through private land with the belief that if you allow them to move and adapt, they will.
Now that, I remember Y2Y, attended a couple of meetings when it was being launched. Mm-hmm. There were some questions scientifically, but I think I would say the consensus or the predominant view was having that kind of movement for certain species was important for genetic diversity.
Correct.
But the scale of it was daunting for me as a conservationist looking at it. You just mentioned all the jurisdictions. You've got different customs. You've got controversial species at that time, grizzly bears in
Absolutely.
Certain places like maybe in along the East Front, one of the most popular animal among some livestock growers.
Yep.
That's a complex sociological, psychological, political undertaking. Tell us about what happened, the good and the bad.
Well, I think what has happened over time, they're still growing strong, is that there has been a growing awareness throughout the country and Canada as well of sort of this idea of large landscapes, looking at things on a much bigger, holistic scale. And it's about including people. It's not about excluding people. It's not about putting wildlife over people. I think it's figuring out ways that we can all work together to protect the values that we share and finding what those values are. And as you said, it was and still is very complex just given the scope of just the landscape and then all of the different entities that are involved. So I think that they're still growing strong and that there is a growing awareness. You hear about sort of wildlife corridors, much smaller ones all over the United States now where people have seen where animals go and want to ensure that they can still go there. And I think people value that and want to see that. And people come to Montana and Wyoming and a lot of these western states to see those things. So again, going back to this idea of conservation has to, you know, make financial sense to people, there's a lot of tourism dollars that come to the states to see things like grizzly bears or pronghorn migrations or elk migrations. And so I think it's a good and interesting model.
Let's talk about it in a little bit of depth. It comes back to me now, and that's 20-some years ago. The response from the ranching community that I got just in initial conversations was not enthusiastic. Corridors for grizzly bears. The immediate implication to them was restriction. Did you have that sort of interaction, either as an organization or individually? And how did it play out? Because that's a pretty deeply held feeling. They're coming to control my land. I don't know what this is. I don't know these people. It probably involves government, maybe the Endangered Species Act. I don't want to go there.
We did a lot. And I think the concept, because there were big circles drawn on maps, alarmed people because they would see their ranches within these circles and think they're going to come take my land.
Yes.
A lot of it was education, and I think it still is. It was not about taking anybody's land. We were not a government entity. We didn't work for the government or the United Nations or anybody else. It was cooperative, and it involved a lot of community meetings and a lot of conversations with folks to hear what their concerns were and try to address those and assure people that we're not trying to take your land. We're trying to look for solutions. And, you know, in our mind, extirpating bears, getting rid of them altogether, wasn't one. How do we make this happen so that ranchers could have their livelihoods and bears could still migrate? And it's a very complex, challenging puzzle. But I think the bottom line there was, how do you bring people together and have discussions so that people understand what is happening? And that was crucial.
It's one thing to say sit down and work it out, it's another to do it, and I speak with personal experience.
Yep.
So with 6 years in, your job was on the development side, right?
I was a fundraiser, yes.
Okay. What concretely happened in that 6 years that you can look back and say we were making progress?
One of the reasons I was fundraising is we passed a lot of money to groups that were on the ground doing stuff in communities.
Okay.
And some of those groups were doing things like building bear-aware programs and bear-proof trash cans in communities so that bears could move through communities without getting in trouble, okay. without having interactions with people, which was a huge issue for them.
Right.
Path of the Pronghorn took root, and that's pronghorn antelope moving in Wyoming.
It's a migratory corridor, I remember.
Yep, and it's now established. I think it was actually nationally established as a wildlife corridor.
Okay.
And then you will see a lot more of them now all over the place, wildlife crossings on highways. You see them in Colorado on Interstate 70. You see them in the Trans-Canada Highway. You see them here outside of Thompson's Falls. We actually have one just outside of Bozeman. It's an underpass. So there are physical, concrete things that are happening to help animals move.
So then you shift from a very large scale, Y2Y, it's hard to get bigger than that, to the Gallatin Valley Land Trust.
Yep.
How's it been and why?
It's been wonderful. I've been the executive director now for 5.5 years. When I worked for Y2Y, a lot of our partners were land trusts all over the United States, and they are working, as I said, to protect private land, and a lot of that land is where animals tend to be. And so there was a sort of natural shift into going from the big picture to being very locally focused, which is very satisfying. We have about 44,000 acres under conservation easement.
The Gallatin Valley Land Trust?
The Gallatin Valley Land Trust. And that's working with 97 families who have wanted to protect their land. And it's all kinds of projects. We have a lot of projects that are in the Bridger Canyon area and Bozeman Pass, where you have a lot of wildlife moving through. So it's helping. Again, going back to what I was talking about with Y2Y, if animals can move, they will tend to. Fences can get in their way. Dogs and cats can get in their way. Roads can get in their way. So protecting a lot of that private land, and a lot of people do those easements because they want to see the elk coming through and the bears, is a great way to continue the work that I was doing with Y2Y on a local level. We also work really closely in the Gallatin Valley with a lot of agricultural operators to try to help keep them on the land and their operations going. We have some of the most fertile soils in the state in the Gallatin Valley. And so we have a lot of farmers and ranchers who have worked to put their property under easement so they can continue to farm and ranch it, as can the next generation and the generation after that.
Now, with Gallatin Valley Land Trust, what's your role? Are you out working with people on the ground, or are you still fundraising? What's your job?
Once a fundraiser, you're always a fundraiser, Brian. You can run, but you can't hide. So a lot of my work is fundraising, yes, to keep the doors open and to keep us able to do our work. But I also do work directly with landowners, talking to them about what it is that they want to do with their land. And it can take years to get a conservation easement finished because it's very personal for these people, these families, and it's a document that's perpetual. It runs
right.
forever. And so you're really talking to folks about what they want and what their kids might want and what their grandkids might want. So it's a big, important decision, and we want people to be really happy with the outcome. And so we work closely with these families to tie their desires in with conservation. And that, as I said, takes a while.
Perpetuity is a long time, and multi-generations in families, and it's not a simple transition leaving out a conservation easement.
Yep.
Give me an example of how
sure.
it's worked.
We deal with lots of families, and some of our ag families have been there for generations, and their fathers and mothers working with sons and daughters, and the parents have considered an easement, and the kids have some concerns about that and potentially having their hands tied.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot of discussions about what that's going to look like. The last thing we want to do is micromanage families. We don't tell them what crops to grow or how to do that. Again, it's, as we talked about earlier, giving up the subdivision rights. And in a place like Bozeman, a lot of land is becoming subdivisions. And one family where the second generation was a little nervous about putting the land under conservation easement, the compelling argument was that ag land will continue to be ag land under a conservation easement because it cannot be developed. And so it will be taxed as ag land.
And valued
as ag land. And that what's compelling there is when a generation dies and they pass it along to their kids, the estate is valued at ag prices, not development prices. And so the estate taxes are less.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times that's the clincher of that next generation being able to afford to keep the ranch or having to sell all or part of it to pay those taxes. And so in this instance that we were talking about, the next generation saw that and thought, wow, this is an opportunity for my parents to be able to pass it to us and us to be able to afford to keep it and continue to farm it as we want to do.
And this is sit down, face to face, multiple conversations.
Absolutely. We have lots of cups of coffee in lots of kitchens. We walk a lot of property. It's the best part of the job. But again, going back to what I said at the very beginning, it's all about people. It's all about making things make sense for people, talking to them, finding out what their dreams are, what their visions are, what is important to them, what will motivate them, how we can help them. That's what this is all about. It's very collaborative. It's very cooperative. As I said, it's voluntary. So that's the best part of what we get to do.
And the money to buy these easements comes from where?
Comes from different sources. We have brought money into the Gallatin Valley from the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is under the Department of Agriculture. So that's federal money. We also have had open space bonds in Gallatin County. So that's county money.
And voted on by the people.
Voted on by the people. $10 million in 2000 and $10 million in 2004.
I see you also have an extensive trail system over 80 miles. That kind of blew me away. What's the story?
We love our trail system. Our founder, we're 26 years old now, saw Bozeman 26 years ago as a place that was going to grow. And he wanted people to be able to get from Main Street in Bozeman to the mountains. We are surrounded by mountains. And
indeed.
So the trail system basically goes north to the Bridgers and south to the Gallatins. And we're about 1 mile away from connecting those. And this is through partnerships with the county and the city and incredibly generous private landowners. But we want people to be able to walk to Yellowstone from the library in downtown Bozeman if they want. And it's getting to where they can do that. And we believe that by building trails, we build community.
How do you see building trails builds community?
Because people get out and they see their neighbors and they walk their dogs and they walk to work and they walk to school. And people are out and about. We're not stuck in our cars. And it gives people a connection to the next door neighbor, to the land, to the natural resources. It's one of the reasons Bozeman is such a special town is the quality of life, and that is being able to walk to school, walk to work, walk to the grocery store, get your dog out, get exercise, have a healthy lifestyle. And that's what our community is all about. But I think the most important part is you meet your neighbors and you meet people you might not have met and you're out and about. And we have found that by building trails, we build a closer community, and people have a lot of ownership in those trails and what they mean to their lives. And they're willing to come out and work to build them, work to maintain them. And I mean, that's one of the things that makes us as special as I believe we are.
You've been at this for quite a while, 26 years. What have you learned about yourself that you didn't know when you started out?
I learned how deeply the natural world impacts my life. I grew up in the city in Washington, D.C., and had never, as I said, had never been west. And that profoundly changed my life. And I've dedicated my life to protecting the natural world so that we can enjoy it. And I feel like I'm the luckiest gal in the world to have gotten to do the things that I've been able to do.
Penelope Pierce, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us on Home Ground.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.